Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And check out my website, Bregan.com, if you haven't been there in a while, Bregin.com. Lots going on. We've got the first in our series, Simple Truths About Psychiatry, free videos. We've got the free email booklet that my wife puts out, this marvelous newsletter that comes out. It's just full of incredible amounts of scientific information and human interest information. And my new book is coming out, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, a guide for prescribers, therapists, patients and their families, giving a really integrated approach, giving a lot more power to therapists and families, and helping prescribers learn to cooperate in that new approach. And those are going to be available in a week or so. And the videos are out from our 2011 conference. They're really good and interesting. So just lots going on. So check out Bregan.com if you haven't been there in a while. My guest today is a very interesting man, Stephen Madigan. Very interesting man. The American Family Therapy Academy, AFTA, recently honored him, gave him a distinguished award for innovative practices in couple and family therapy. Those of you who know me a little bit know that I think that couples and family therapy are probably the best way when the opportunity is there to help people, because you're helping folks learn to help each other and help themselves, and you're often dealing with the healing core that's available to people. He's got an MSW and a PhD in marriage and family therapy. He runs the Vancouver School for Narrative Therapy in Vancouver, Canada. And he just got a lot of interesting things going. He's got a DVD series. He's got a book out that maybe he could explain something to us about through APA. Maybe that's it's a book along with a 6-part live sessions. I'm looking forward to a really interesting time. Are you there?
Yes, I'm there, Peter. Hello.
Did I get it right, more or less right? I mean, you really do look like a man doing interesting stuff.
Yeah, the community here in Vancouver has been doing some interesting things for about 20 years now. Yep. That's a very vibrant and exciting culture of therapy and community workers we have here in Canada on the West Coast.
Well, that's marvelous. I'm happy to have you begin anywhere. Tell us about the evolution of your interests. I want people to leave this show feeling they understand for the first time in their lives something about narrative therapy, get a sense of what you're doing, how you got there.
Okay, but before I start on narrative therapy, Peter, I just really want to say how good it is for me to speak with you. I ran into your work, the book, your book on toxic psychiatry when I was doing my PhD in marriage and family therapy in Florida. And it really helped my dissertation. And it sat alongside some other great thinkers throughout the course of my writing of the dissertation. So I just really want to thank you up front for that. And it's just so nice to talk with you in person 20 years down the track. And I said to you earlier, I've just come back from a family gathering in Ireland, and very recently. And while I was there, I came across a quote, and I just dug it up before before we went on the air today, and I want to read it to you, and because it really marks and represents, I think, my impression of all the truly political and very good work that you've done, in my estimation. And the quote goes like this: "It's a critique does not consist in simply saying that things aren't good the way they are. It consists in seeing on just what type of assumptions, of familiar notions, of established and unexamined ways of thinking the accepted practices are based. To do criticism is to make harder those acts which are now too easy." That's a quote from one of my other heroes, Michel Foucault. So thank you. Well, I suppose what I always come back to in attempting to describe the work of narrative therapy is the following question. And that question is, who has the storytelling rights to the story being told? And I'm talking specifically about mental health. And my feeling is that the professional mental health not spent nearly enough time in considering the question on storytelling rights regarding who gets to say what about whom and with what authority. Because I get the sense that it's quite easy to get the rights to begin naming people, and through names and diagnosis, it leads to all manner of other kinds of assumptions that are often land on the backs of the people that we work with in therapy. So narrative therapy was brought into existence by the Australian therapist Michael White and a Canadian therapist, come New Zealand immigrant, by the name of David Epstein. And I do think that it's interesting that narrative therapy took place outside of North America, or got its start outside of North America. And they began their novel therapeutic work in narrative therapy back in the early 1980s. But it didn't they didn't really coin the term narrative therapy until 1989. But by the 1990s, the early 1990s, their ideas had a relatively small but passionate following throughout North America and Europe. And now in 2012, narrative therapy finds itself at the theoretical center of thousands and thousands of therapy and therapist practices worldwide. And I suppose the largest interest outside of North America in Europe these days seems to be coming out of countries like Brazil and South Korea and Hong Kong, where there's an enormous amount of interest. So much has been written about the magic or the difference or the mystique of narrative therapy practice, so I'll just try and give you a small, very brief introduction, and then maybe you and I can talk about it a little bit or talk about the nuances. And later on down the track, if you'd like, a particular person I worked with comes to mind that might give you a further explanation. But I imagine what made narrative therapy practice different from what had preceded it in the fields of psychology, psychiatry, social work, was the decision by Michael White and David Epstein to embrace the enormous body of scholarship directed towards uncovering the ideological, the political, and the ethical biases underlying the authority for psychological knowledge. They were really questioning how it is that psychological knowledge was rendered unobstructed. So they began to stand away from psychology and all psychological knowledge, which left them on some pretty unusual shores. They were standing there as therapists, seemingly by themselves from where they were standing. And so instead of turning towards psychology and psychiatry for their theoretical inspiration, White and Epstein turned away from all this prevailing psychological, psychiatric, and systemic knowledge and all other theoretical and practice views informed by individualism. And instead, I guess they moved their therapy practice towards specific post-structural theories that informed ideas regarding a relational identity, So rather than looking at an individualist identity, they were looking at bodies of knowledge that spoke to a relational identity. And they found these ideas situated within the disciplines of, at the time anyway, in the mid-80s, the disciplines of cultural anthropology and feminism, post-colonialism, some work in anti-oppression and social justice. The literary theoreticians were moving in this direction, and so was some queer theorists, just to name a few, of the disciplines. So in addition, they were also influenced by the leading voices of French post-structural philosophy from, say, circa 1965 to the present, but primarily the work of Michel Foucault. And so White and Epstein's philosophical turn away from psychological theory and practice, along with their deft ability to translate the high disciplines of post-structural theory into a helpful day-to-day practice of therapy, really jettison this unlikely pair onto the world stage and towards international notoriety. And so much so that a psychologist by the name of McLeod, in 1997, he went as far as to categorize narrative therapy as the field's first and perhaps only post-psychological therapy. So narrative therapists perceive that all formal diagnostic analysis produces flat monologic descriptions of psychological life that attempts to render events predictable. So we found that psychology's more formalized descriptions of personhood, they seem to like champion the norm through generalizations. So they seem to champion the idea of a person's stories through really broad-based generalizations regarding who people actually are, quote-unquote. Whereas narrative therapy metaphors are based in a dialogic encounter, so rendering the unexpected invisible and unique so as to be misled by the general. So we're not looking at generalizations. So I suppose a post-psychological practice, just to get back to McLeod, means a practice of therapy that has ideas that question the underpinnings of psychological knowledge and practice, and we move beyond psychology's foundation of the ideological, theoretical, and practice tenets that sort of form their foundation. So from the beginning, a central post-structural tenet of narrative therapy was the idea that we as persons are multi-storied and not single-storied. So simply stated, narrative therapy took up a position that within the context of therapy, there could be numerous interpretations about persons and problems. And the very interpretations of persons and problems therapists bring forward are mediated through prevailing ideas held by our culture regarding the specifics of who and what these persons and problems are and what they represent. So do they represent abnormal, normal, good, bad, worthy, unworthy, and all these bifurcated terms we tend to come up with, or psychology tends to come up with. So narrative therapy contends that to properly study a self, quote-unquote, a reader must understand how it is related to his or her own personal concept of the self. The self is somewhat taken for granted as that skin-bound, individualized notion. But narrative therapy point of view, it brings forth a multi-sided and multi-storied idea of the subject about who we are as persons. And narrative therapy's approach to the self stretches out beyond the more popular and generalized accounts of, you know, who persons are. So these dominant and individualized categories of personhood and of who the person is stated or labeled to be by the expert of psychological knowledge. So what we're looking at is that we are really looking at the politics of identity in terms of how it is a person has come to know themselves at this time. And we believe that because we are only looking at the politics of identity and interaction, with a much broader dominant culture, we strongly feel that the very active therapy is a political act. Now, Peter, you can tell me to stop at any time because I may.
Well, I was going to ask you to focus in now some on what happens in therapy? Are there two people talking? Is there a written narrative? Is it all verbal? What do you do? What happens?
I think in therapy, I see probably 50, at this time in my practice, I probably see about 50% are couples and the rest are individuals and families. And I tend to only ask questions. I ask questions that are related to a post-structural theory of identity. And what that means is that what I'm trying to do is to hear out this rather hypnotic problem story. So often people come to therapy, as you know, and they tell this rote story of themselves. And my guess is that that story is a very thin description of who that person is and who it is that they have been and who it is that they might become. But also in therapy, there's a lot of practices of the written word. So I write a lot of therapeutic letters as follow-up to the sessions that I'm involved with. I also do things like therapeutic letter writing campaigns. And basically what we're doing is that this construction of identity is that these stories aren't neutral and not without negative effects, because we have this sense that the stories that we tell ourselves and that we are constructed with, who it is we are told that we are and how it is that we conceive life and who we are positioned in that life, be it through gender or race or class, is how it is that we perform life. So stories that are spoken and are told, be it in therapy or in our relationships, they're performed. And we perform these lives or these sets of stories. And
Steve, let me interrupt a minute. You've got a live session DVD series. Can you give us a sense of what we'd be seeing? Because all this is very abstract, very political. I'm not getting much of a sense of what's happening between the people and you. Maybe you could describe a live session from your DVD series of working with a couple.
Well, actually, I'll tell you that the live series, I did three sessions, three live sessions. I went to Chicago every Tuesday, I think, and they filmed with an eight-person film crew every Wednesday. And the DVD that they selected was with a fellow who was really struggling with less than worthiness, a lot of nervousness, and what he'd been diagnosed with, severe depression and anxiety. This is a fellow who hadn't worked in 10 years and at one point had been housebound because of the problem for 2 years, never leaving the house. So I didn't get any background on the fellow, and we just filmed it over the course of 6 weeks. And what you would see there is this fellow and I beginning to talk, and him telling me about this terribly thin description of himself as a very less than worthy person, and that he really didn't live up to expectations of who he should be as a worker or as a man. And so we began to look at these stories, at these very thin conclusions that he'd come to, and he'd been in and out of psychiatric hospitals. And what we began to realize is that there was a lot that had been left out of this man's stories, a lot of bold achievements and unique outcomes that small achievements that he'd made in his life that hadn't really been included in the story that it was that he'd been living.
Like what? Give some examples of what were these bold achievements.
Well, at one point, he told me that he liked to play guitar, and that's one of the things that the depression had really stolen away from him, was that he could no longer play in public. And when I began to ask him about this, he told me that that people had told him in the past he sounded a lot like Jimi Hendrix. So he had these abilities of being a guitar player. He also had an ability to strip down and build back up a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. He also had taken himself to some of these groups you know, these support groups that are offshoots of AA. And so I was just wondering, you know, I would ask him questions, you know, like what rules of the depression and the anxiety did he have to break in order to get himself out of the house? Like, what was it in his life that really began to support him, that told him that he was worthy of getting some help? Because the story that kept him inside is that he was worthy of nothing, and that perhaps the best conclusion for him was this despairing future, which would mean to kill himself. So gradually, surely, we moved a little bit further. We began to bring forth some of these other counter-identities, or include these identities of himself as a very skilled person, a very skilled musician, and really began to pit himself against the problem's definition of him and this more inclusive definition of himself that included all of his qualities, etc. As you'll see through the six sessions, he begins to take risks, and he begins to get very angry at this very imprisoned life that he'd been living. He was 54 years old. And he began to really stand up against some of these notions of himself that he'd been told of himself, and began to stand up against all the prescription drugs that he'd been given through the years. And he really began to take a stand for himself and really and began to see that there was a future that was somewhat possible for him.
Well, this sounds like good therapy. Where does the political conceptualization fit in? Does he begin to ask questions that change his political context? Because, you know, Foucault is very, very politically oriented, obviously, and what you're describing could be any good therapy. So what's going on that's particularly different?
One of the things that we began to look at is dominant ideas around masculinity. You know, that he believed that he had to be a hero. He believed that he didn't measure up to society's expectations of what it meant to be a man. And through this, he began to have the sense that other people were seeing him as a less than worthy specimen of a man. So what that meant was, the consequences of that meant, was that he didn't work, felt like a failure, he couldn't support himself, couldn't have a relationship, etc. We began to look at who it was that made up these single solitary definitions of what man's life is supposed to be, and began to offer other alternative notions as to ways in the world that he was that had a different description of who a man could be, meaning he was a very caring person. He there were many, many countless stories of him that lived outside the dominant frame of what masculinity was his idea of what masculinity was to be. And so that was very liberating for him, we found. I spent a lot of time consulting to eating disorder wards throughout North America, both here in Vancouver and throughout America. And, you know, the idea of, you know, this young woman struggling with anorexia or bulimia, often the label or the acts of anorexia and bulimia are located inside the young woman's body. Now, my sense is that none of these young women invented anorexia. And my sense is that there is the politics of the body around cultural specifications, around who women should be. There is this idea of certain practices of the body that have become more and more pervasive and more dominant since the early 80s. So I think what I found in working with people struggling with anorexia and bulimia, and the hundreds and hundreds of young women and men that I've worked with, and now more men and more older women that are struggling with this, anorexia and bulimia, is that without a definition around taking the problem outside of the person's body and moving it into a broader cultural context to see that this is a, you know, possible explanation could be a result of consumerism and post-capitalism, etc., it's very difficult for these people to get their lives back. Does that make sense?
Yes, I understand what you're saying. A lot of it sounds like good therapy, but I mean, I think the last thing that you said, I think, is of special interest to me, because you're bringing in, you know, the political analysis of capitalism and, you know, a critique of capitalism. You probably don't know that I don't come from any longer. I did when I was young. I don't come any longer from what would be called a progressive orientation. But I certainly I share the basic knowledge and understanding of the issues of men in our culture and women in our culture, and certainly of anorexia and so on. But what interests me a lot is that I'm probably somebody that. That is quite different politically from you. I wasn't in the beginning, you know, for my first 30 or so years. Read a lot of Foucault and so on. And my concern would be whether you're covertly bringing in another outsider's way of looking at this individual person. I'm very aware of that in my own work, because here in Ithaca, New York, many of my clients are very... would love your analysis. Many of my clients, and I'm very open with them, that my own view is different. I've written a book called Wow, I'm an American, which I think might curdle your hair, just the title. But it's about founding values, individualism, individual liberty, and so on. So I'm very interested. Maybe when we get back, we could talk some about this issue of how do we avoid seeing the person who's coming to help for help from us through our own particular prism of politics. Something that I think, for example, if you were treating people here in Ithaca, they would take for granted a lot of the way you're looking at things, but they'd still be suffering and have a lot of problems. If you would be working more where I live out in the country, folks would look at you and say, "Well, I don't like where you're going." So it'd be interesting to look at that when we come back. We've got just a few minutes now, but any thoughts of yours to finish up the half hour, just a minute or two? Maybe in response to what question I'm opening up, and then we'll go to break.
The politics that we're talking about is how it is that we describe the self. It's not necessarily whether you're right-wing or left-wing. It's the politics of identity, of how it is that we are constructed, and primarily, where do we locate problems? Do we locate, say, depression, anxiety, anorexia inside the person's body, or... do we have more of a relational, political description that looks at how these problems were first constructed? Is anorexia, like many people are saying now, and millions of research dollars, is it located in the frontal lobe of the brain? Or actually, is this socially constructed? You know, is there something going on in North America that has such high rates of eating disorders? That's the politic that I'm talking about, not whether or not you're left-wing or right-wing. Right?
No, I understand. I definitely understand what you're saying. I think if I were to say where did anorexia start, I'd say probably Great Britain with Twiggy. Rather than North America, but God knows it's a problem wherever people start to accept the whole advertising dominant view. And I have no doubt that it has a lot to do with marketing and with industry and the free market. But that's a large issue, and I think it's interesting when you try to bring a very large conception to helping individual people. How do you avoid recruitment? One of the things that I'm proud of, and I think I should be, is that hardly any of my clients, my patients, become psychiatric reformers, and hardly any of them change their political viewpoint, but they feel more empowered. But let's, this is complicated stuff. We're getting near break. Let's go to break and take a breath and kind of see if we can talk about maybe the toughest issues on earth, which are the broader political context of doing therapy.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. My guest is Stephen Madigan. Stephen, you there?
Yes, I'm here, Peter. Thanks.
Tell people how they can get in touch with you. Googling you works, but is there a special way to get in touch with you?
If you want to go to our website, it's therapeuticconversations.com. And you can get to me through there. So we do a lot of training up here. And we're just about to launch a very exciting project called narrativetherapy.tv. So we'll be bringing you the best of all of the workshops and keynote speakers and from our conferences dating back to 1993. So that will all be coming up online probably by October of this year.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to just give the mic back to you for a few minutes. Are you comfortable? I didn't have any idea where this show was going. Are you comfortable with talking about these issues in terms of the political and maybe differences in how this works out in therapy?
Absolutely, Peter. I'd be more than happy to talk more about that.
All right. What about my concerns that I'm raising? I'd just like to give you a chance to start off the second almost half hour.
Well, as I was mentioning just before we went to break, we're talking about the politics of identity. We're not talking about right or left-wing politics, Republican or Democratic politics. That's not the description that I'm using. What we're talking about is how it is that we see problems and their relationship to persons. And if I think that if we take a very individualized idea, say for example in the case problem that we were discussing, anorexia, if we were to see the person from an individualized perspective who's struggling with anorexia, we will locate that anorexia inside their body and cut them off somewhat, for the most part, relationally. And I saw this in many, many psychiatric eating disorder wards. And the result of that, once we individualize problems and locate them in persons' bodies like that and not see them relationally or post-structurally, the result of that is the person tends to be medicated because the answer to the location or host of the problem is the person themselves. So what we tend to do is just try and fix that person and not relate that person's experience to a much broader dominant experience of what's going on culturally in terms of, in this case, this woman's life.
Okay. Well, you know, I tend to think that, in fact, abusive psychiatry has tended to cut across the whole spectrum of political views. I mean, if we go to the Marxist view, which focuses entirely on the environment, where that has been fully expressed, we have very oppressive psychiatry and horrible drugging. So yeah. You know, I don't mean to be simplistic in making these divisions up, but let me ask a couple of questions. When my patients come to see me, My view is basically that as individual human beings, it's our task to take charge of our lives, take as complete responsibility as we can for our lives, examine the harmful influences that have affected us. In a simplistic way, that would be certainly not just the advertising and the marketing of skinniness and of unisex and so on, but people who move in that direction often are very much influenced by their immediate families. I'd be looking at that with them and how their mother or father's drivenness and perfectionism affected them and maybe attitudes towards sex and not wanting to have a sexual body affected them. I certainly, while looking at marketing, I would, but I wouldn't necessarily believe, I think, that capitalism was the root source. And in particular, I would find the solution inside the individual. That is, I would say to the individual, while we're going to look at the context, the racism that you've experienced, or the sexism, or the anti-Semitism that you've experienced, or the devaluation of your work that you've experienced, within you is the power to find a better spiritual outlook that may or may not include becoming a reformer, and usually for most people it does not. Now, that's kind of be a bit of a different formulation from your approach, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. That's exactly, I mean, I say this very respectfully, Dr. Bregan, but that's exactly the formulation that narrative therapy turned away from.
That's what I'm thinking. But it's a political formulation. I do believe it is associated with a basically Marxist view.
If we even look at Foucault, he never claimed to be a Marxist. But what if you're reading in contemporary literature, if you're reading post-colonial literature or post-feminist literature or queer literature,
the very word post-colonial, you know, gets us into that whole political viewpoint. But tell me now, all right, so I'm going to be treating someone in that fashion. I'll be encouraging them to look at sexism in their lives, racism. I do that all the time. I think most good therapists, we do. But I'm not going to go where you're going because I'd feel that was indoctrination.
Right.
Where you think it's truth.
See, my thing is it's a wonderful word that you've just used, and I see that these young women who are struggling with anorexia or eating disorders, and I think we can extrapolate that with a variety of other problems, have been indoctrinated into certain practices of the body. And
certainly,
so I think that it's fair that we locate the problem in the self. This is a relational, contextual, cultural difficulty that we are, when we individualize people, we are cutting them off from the context from which it was born. So when you said, I have my PhD is in family therapy, so, but I think that these descriptions of, over-involved mother, under-involved father, that's not what I saw. I mean, all of us are under the dictates of dominant ideas of what is right and what is wrong and who is in and who is out and who is up and who is down. So narrative therapy, even though we all started in family therapy, and we were enamored during the halcyon days when family therapy was actually thinking, and now not sponsored by drug companies and whatnot in their conferences, like the AMFT currently is. What we began to look at is that we needed to begin to identify what is this self and how is it constructed. It's no longer just systemic.
But how do you empower the person? How do you, in your work, when this person's empowered, how are they thinking about themselves now? How are they thinking differently than I'm suggesting, which is that the fundamental challenge to life has always been to take responsibility for ourselves and our loved ones and to make as good a life as we can, and if we want to also increase human liberty to do the same. Now, you're going to be thinking really differently about all this.
Yeah, I do. I think that, and again, respectfully, I think that When people begin to realize that they didn't invent this eating disorder on their own, that they didn't come to this on their own, that actually they've been indoctrinated, or there's dominant ideas that have been produced and now they're just reproducing them. When people come to these conclusions like, oh, geez, it's not just a deficit identity. It's not just that I'm a failure. It's not just that I'm this shame-based person who doesn't quite measure up. There's a much broader set of influences. And then when I begin to get the full picture of the influences, then I can begin to pick more preferred ways of being. That I want to stand against this and I want to stand with this. But they have a much broader understanding rather than just this simple individualized idea that they have an eating disorder and it's in them and there's no real contextual understanding or relational understanding as to how this young person got to this. We can use this same example with a lot of the corporate people that I work with these days who are really struggling under the weight of corporate demands. Now, I'm anti-corporate. All I'm saying is the practices of being in a corporation these days, one of the offshoots of that, it is producing cultures of anxiety and depression that wasn't necessarily there, 15 years ago. Cultures are shifting, and people that are involved in interacting contextually in these are suffering the weight. And the problem is that it's not the problem of corporations. The problem is that people are blaming themselves for how they feel rather than having a more relational and contextual view.
Behind your view, I think there is a utopian ideal for how people ought to relate to each other and how society should be organized economically. Is that so?
No.
No.
Absolutely no. All I'm saying is that I'm not going to weigh in to tell anybody how it is, what is the best way for them to live their life. Couples often ask me, tell us what to do and how we should be as a couple. And I often say, why are you asking me this? I barely know what to do with my own life. So I'm not into prophesizing any particular way. My point is that we hold a very relational view in terms of persons and problems and relationships. And that when people come to better understandings, for example, couples. So if I'm working with a heterosexual couple, there are dominant ways that couples have been indoctrinated into being that sometimes become quite problematic. And what they don't begin to fully understand is that much of their relationship is lived outside of these dominant ideas. And they've come to these unique understandings of one another or how the culture of their own particular relationship works. And maybe they need to stand behind those ideas more than what they're being told about
We're really in sync on these basic kinds of ideas. How do you deal with the issue of personal responsibility?
Well, again, you see, let's talk. The best example of this is men's violence. And so I work with a lot of men who perpetuate intimate violence against women and children, right, in their families. Okay, so I was initially of the place where men needed to take responsibility. Of course they do. So I would invite them and have these discussions, which we called invitations to responsibility. However, I began to realize that these individual men did not get to this place completely on their own. So we have broad-based discussions around responsibility, but also that there are a variety of cultures of men. Now, there are men who are nonviolent, just to bifurcate it. There are men who are violent. There are men who are nonviolent. Now, basically, what we're saying is that we enter into these conversations where people begin to prefer and to take choices and begin to say, why is it that you would prefer to stand in this way of being as a man as opposed to this violent way of being a man? What we're seeing is that me, you, and anyone that grew up, at least where I did in Toronto, in the neighborhood that I grew up in, and the men that were around, we were all trained in violence. Now, I'm not a violent man, but I was certainly trained in it. I know all the tactics of violence. So what we need to do is begin to unearth this, and again, to not lock this man down and say, you need anger management training and you need to do this, because it isolates them, where we actually live in a culture that perpetuates men's violence. Is that clear?
Yes. I think there are subtle differences. If I were working with a couple and the man walks in and I see his arm twitch and his wife cringes, I'd say to this man, I think you've been hitting your wife. I'm sure of it. I just saw her grimace. And I would say to him probably in the first session, well, that should end today. Today you're going to find out that there's so much better ways to get what you want. So many better ways to get what you want than what you're doing. So I'd be very direct. And I think your wife should call a sheriff if you hit her again. But I don't think you're going to do it anymore, because I think you get a sense that I know what I'm talking about and that I want to help you have a relationship with your wife where you guys are really making each other's lives better. And I want to teach you how to do that. Now, that would be the opening, something like that, which I think sounds probably a fair different than what you would do. Then later on, I might get into the male cultural stuff. But if the man's really, really violent, the odds are we'll find out that he was profoundly trained specifically by people in his family to be violent, along with the cultural aspects of violence. I don't think the society we live in is by any means the most culturally violent male society ever or even on Earth. I think compared to male violence in the Middle East or in parts of Africa and so on, this is not by any means the most violent culture there ever was or the worst one to grow up in terms of violence. But we would look at those aspects of it. But I have a feeling you're looking at another a context that is saying something a bit different than I am.
You know, a little bit, yes. And again, respectfully, so I have an upcoming benefit that I'm doing for the Battered Women's Support Services here in Vancouver, and I do it alongside their director. And last year, like, the incidence of violence, reported violence, intimate violence, is rising. Now, I'm not comparing it to any other place in the world. All I know is that this beautiful place called Vancouver in Canada, there's so much violence that nobody really knows about. There were 30,000 calls last year, over 30,000 calls in the local environment of 1 million people.
So you have increasing unemployment there?
Well, we actually didn't actually, I know what you're talking about, but we actually didn't go through the recession in 2008 like many, many countries around the world did.
That's what I thought, yes. So why do you think there's a rising violence in Vancouver right now?
Well, I think that there's many, many explanations. You probably have to talk with them because they seem to be the experts. But I think that part of this is this, again, sorry, I keep coming back to this, but the rise of individualism and the negation of community. It's that I think that people are living further and further apart and splintered more and more apart. So what's happening in the cultures of men and women, whatever it is that's going on them and them feeling less connected, perhaps less worthy, there seems to be more violence. And I honestly, Peter, I haven't really contemplated that. All I know is that it's happening.
Well, I'm certain that where society disintegrates, where family life disintegrates, where community disintegrates, I mean, we are social creatures. There you and I are very much in accord. I believe we're made of each other. I believe we're social creatures. But I think that that when you're talking about postmodern and you get into the critique of capitalism, that you're going somewhere else that I'm not sure you're sort of fully fessing up about, because the language you're using are code words. They're code words. So I'm a little confused, because I thought you would actually be more you'd come forth more and say, yeah, we do want a reorganization of the economic relationships and so on.
Oh, no, I think that class, I mean, there are a lot of issues, but what I'm saying is that I'm talking about post-capitalism, and I'm talking about rabid consumerism, and I'm saying that this is the culture that has been produced, and because of this culture at this particular time, it's manifesting into problems, or a culture that is experiencing very unique mental health issues. And I'm not suggesting that.
You're breaking up.
Okay. And I'm not suggesting that, Marxism or any other political system is going to be necessarily better. What I'm saying is what's being produced politically these days in our culture in North America, and I can speak specifically for Canadians, it is manifesting in a lot of different kinds of mental health issues. And there's a great rise of mental health issues at this time. So why can't we talk to the culture of what might be producing these mental health issues, or the political climate?
Well, see, I'm 100% in favor of that, and I think poverty, and I think unemployment, and I think masculinity issues and femininity issues. You know, we have a broad base of agreement, but you're shifting the locus outside the individual, which is what you wish to do. And I think when you do that, I think you take away the great energy of human beings, which is responsibility and liberty, not changing society so much as letting free people live and develop their societies and modify them and grow them. So, and I think Canada is one of the better countries in the world in that regard. And I think that's why living in Canada is probably better than living in most places in the world, because you still do have a lot of respect for responsibility and individualism. So, see, the conclusions we come to are really different, and I think would reflect very, very much on what the influence we're having is going to be quite different on people, I think.
Well, I think, the way I go about this, and perhaps the way you go about it, I mean, my intention, as I imagine your intention is to be as respectful as possible and to help people move quickly as possible to out of the despair of problems and more towards, a more preferred life. I just want to go back and say one last thing, though, this idea of having, individual responsibility and free will, it is, my sense is that it's only in relation to what's going on around us. So we can only think about ourselves, for example, as men or parents or workers, within the frame that is only being given to us. We are very limited and restrained in terms of this idea of liberty. This idea of, I think one of the major problems in mental health right now is how it is that the field of mental health is so crucified to the idea of individualism, and that it's not more interactive, contextual, cultural, and that we don't have more interactive, relational descriptions of how people have come to know themselves in these very disparate ways these days.
Thank you, Stephen Madigan. The music has come upon me more quickly than I expected. And this is Peter Bregan, and we do have to end just a little more quickly than I thought. This has been a really interesting discussion, and I think we need to have more of them. But the problem in psychiatry is not individualism, it's the abuse of the individual.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregan and his lifelong reform work on www.bregan.com. That's BREGGIN.com.